On this episode of the Symbolic World Podcast, I will be playing for you a discussion I had with Father Stephen Domic. Father Stephen has become a staple in North American Orthodoxy. He has a podcast, he has written a book, and he's also doing videos. He actually has two podcasts, so he's really, really involved. And what we wanted to talk about was his new podcast, which looks at the relationship between J.R. Tolkien and how some of his world building and the manner in which he describes the world, how it can be understood through an Orthodox lens, how it has some similarities with Orthodoxy. And so we really talked about how stories can be applicable to our lives in the world and how that is really the core of symbolism, not some abstract understanding of something, but to see how the patterns can be used to apply in other circumstances. So just to remind you that everything I'm doing here, all the videos, all the podcasts are done thanks to your support. So you can go to thesymbolicworld.com/support and find ways to help out the podcast. To all the patrons, all the people who are helping me out, I am offering often some advanced view of videos, but mostly now I've started doing one video a month, which is just for patron and is an interpretation of some traditional stories. So this month I am doing Rumpelstiltskin. So please enjoy the discussion, and I'll talk to you soon. This is Jonathan Peugeot. Welcome to the Symbolic World. Hello, everybody. I am sitting here with Father Andrew Domic. Father Domic is an Orthodox priest. He's also an author. He's written a few books, and he is a podcaster. He's been doing several podcasts, but mostly recently he started an interesting podcast on the relationship between Christianity in general, Orthodoxy in particular, and Tolkien's work in The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion and his other works. And so I thought it would be a really interesting opportunity to talk to Father Andrew, just because I know a lot of you who are watching me are interested in stories like mythology, like traditional stories, and a lot of you are also fans of Tolkien. So Father Andrew, maybe you could introduce yourself a little bit. Tell us about your journey. I know you are a convert to Orthodoxy as well. You know, your journey into Orthodoxy, but also to Tolkien and to these types of stories.
Well, thank you very much. Well, first thing I'll say to introduce myself is that my last name is pronounced Damic.
Damic. Well, I will try to be careful with that.
Yeah, it's not a really common name, actually. And in fact, is a sort of Americanization of a Lithuanian name, which is Domeika, which I kind of wish sometimes that my great-grandfather had just sort of left it alone. But here we are. But yeah, for me, actually, the journey into Orthodoxy and J.R.R. Tolkien are kind of bound up together. And the reason for that is that having read Tolkien from when I was quite young, I would say, I don't know, maybe starting 8 or 9 years old, you know, that very much shaped my imagination and shaped my my worldview in terms of what was not just sort of possible, but kind of what I expected from the world. Mm-hmm. And I think then when I encountered the Orthodox Church in my early 20s, so I've been Orthodox now for about 21 years. When I encountered the Orthodox Church in my early 20s, in some sense, it was like an experience of, wait, it's all real? You know, like this kind of world where the transcendent is just at the threshold of the imminent, that's actually a thing? You know, so I was very receptive to Orthodoxy, I think, as a result of that. And not that my evangelical Protestant upbringing regarded the world as flat, but it kind of sequestered the miraculous and the supernatural into the Bible and into some time in the future, mm-hmm. largely speaking, although it did kind of allow for the possibility of miracles even in our own day.
Yeah,
but it wasn't like it was like we were walking up to the threshold every time we went to church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not what we did.
Yeah.
Whereas as an Orthodox Christian, I would say that's that's what I do. You know, that is my normal daily life. So, you know, my vocation is as a parish priest. So I'm a pastor of a church in Eastern Pennsylvania, and I'm also a husband and a father. I have four kids, and I've been podcasting with Ancient Faith Radio for about a decade now. And this new podcast that you mentioned is actually my fourth podcast. And I've also got a few books with Ancient Faith Publishing and some blogs, and I just sort of seem to accumulate content, much as you yourself do. So that's kind of me in a nutshell.
Well, I think it's very interesting. One of the, I've noticed that, you know, with Nicholas Kotar, but also with just priests in general, when I meet Orthodox priests, they do have this kind of strange token culture, especially converted priests, it seems, and a lot of Orthodox converts. And I think the way that you phrased it to say, you know, that, wait a minute, you know, this is real. I can actually live in a story that has this magical quality to it. I think that you really hit the nail on the head in the sense that, you know, the liturgical life and this idea, even the fact that priests, even their vestments, you know, when you see a priest, there's something about it that is accepting of a grander reality, of something which is more. And, you know, when you read the Tolkien and you read this idea of an ancient world, which is almost also being lost, you could say, and there's this, it kind of peaks in, you know, and all of a sudden you get a sense that you're connected to this ancient thing. And I think that that's also something that is there, should be there, at least in Christianity. Once you start, when you read, you know, the early church fathers, for example, when I read St. Gregory of Nyssa, it was exactly as if I was plunged into this magical world. And I thought, you know, I can live in this story. My life can be plunged into this story, the same story that Moses was part of, you know, and I think that it's an amazing thing that we have access to.
Yeah. I know some Orthodox converts, their sense of this can sometimes get a little misdirected towards pining for the glories of some particular past Orthodox culture or something like that. Yeah. But the truth is really that this, if we should have any kind of nostalgia, it should be nostalgia for paradise, right? In which the veil between the transcendent and the imminent is basically not there. You know, the Adam and Eve walk with God in the garden. You know, and so I've seen that, but I think what you're saying is true, that there's this sense of connecting with something ancient, something powerful, something where you know, the divine, the mystical is just kind of on the edge of our actual experience. And I think a lot of that is based on what we expect actually of our story. Like, mm-hmm. Do I expect that I'm going to encounter the divine, or have I just sort of accepted that that's not a thing in my world, even if I'm a believer in it, mm-hmm. right? I might agree that it's there, but not really kind of be desiring it and wanting it or expecting it, certainly. And I think that's one of the things that Orthodox Christianity in some sense takes as a given, actually, mm-hmm. you know, that simply God is there and he actually does love us and he's touching us and connecting with us and his saints are just there kind of on the edge of our consciousness. Yeah. Right. So,
but I think that's something that right now it's such a great time to talk about this, because there's a sense I'm seeing even in the secular community, I'm seeing an awakening to as science reaches its limit, you could say, in terms of understanding the human person and is hitting up against the problem of consciousness and the problem of what it means for a meaning-making conscious agent to be the one who is observing the world and how that interaction is extremely complicated. The possibility of speaking of the other only word I can use for people to understand is of speaking of these principalities, of the notion that there are principalities which surround us and which are forming our world, and we have the chance to participate in that, and this kind of amazing hierarchy of saints and of angels leads up and points us to the absolute transcendence. I think that now is just such a great time to talk about that. I have seen in my dealing with kind of post-atheist people at first, when you talk about angels,
they think you're talking about, you know, I mean, they think you're just talking that they're actually winged people that fly around in the sky to finally saying, oh, okay, all right, I see that. I see what you mean. And I also see what you mean when you point to the fact that even you as a person, there's an aspect of you that you cannot fully contain within the quantitative world, you could say. And it's kind of leading people to the to now again, looking at old stories, looking at myth. And the great thing about Tolkien is he was able to create a world that was almost was so completely coherent in terms of its mythology. Is not at all Christian. And I think that's also important. It's not at all Christian in its, let's say, in its outer aspect.
Yeah, but right.
When you look at it, you see that the pattern that is behind it reveals something that can help you understand what it means to be a Christian in the world. And I think that that to me is one of the most interesting things that Tolkien can bring to us.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting. If you read Tolkien's letters, for instance, he talks a lot about his intentions for his creation and sub-creation, to use the Tolkien term.
Right.
One of the things that he says is that he says that it's actually a Christian and Catholic work particularly, but there's a lot of people who are not Christians or maybe have no religious involvement at all, who, if they read that bit from his letter, might think, wait, what? I don't see Jesus in here anywhere. What do you mean by that? You know, but I think part of the difficulty, of course, is that we often look at things on a more superficial level, rather than seeing kind of the deeper substrates of what's going on.
And you know, it's almost like I kind of see it the way that it's almost as if Tolkien's world is an alternative Old Testament, you know, where there you have all these types, these small types of characters that will manifest one aspect, let's say, of Christ, or one aspect of the fullness of the Christian revelation. Just like in the Old Testament, all the figures kind of point to Christ, but Christ is not there, you know. And so it is like kind of this funnel that points you to the final revelation, you could say, which is not in the story. And I think that all good stories, that's what they should do. I always, you know, a lot of people really like C.S. Lewis. I remember reading C.S. Lewis when I was younger and liking a few of the books, but not totally getting into it so much. And I think part of it was because of that problem, is that, you know, Aslan is Jesus. Okay, I get it. And then it gets weird, because sometimes he does things and you're wondering, okay, well, if Aslan's Jesus, why is he doing this? And why is he acting like this? It just becomes very, very strange. Whereas in Tolkien, you don't have that problem, because all the characters are kind of manifesting different aspects of reality. And if you kind of bring it together, then you see something behind it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I have loved Lewis probably just almost as long as I've loved Tolkien, but the point that you make, I think, is a good one. And, you know, I would say that Tolkien's Middle Earth, and well, actually Middle Earth is just a continent in his world, but his sub-creation, the whole cosmos that he's created, is much more perfect and coherent than Lewis's Narnia.
Yeah.
But if I can just give one small plug for Lewis, I think he actually, and this is not for Narnia, I think Lewis actually achieved this, the thing that Tolkien, I think, did best. I think Lewis achieved it in some measure with his final novel, which is Till We Have Faces.
Okay.
Which is not, you know, within Narnia, and it's really a pagan story, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think because Lewis wasn't trying to present Jesus in particular, that it actually presents a more Christian world than Narnia does, interestingly enough. But
I've not read it, so maybe this is a plug for me to go into that.
Yeah, you should check it out. I think it is actually Lewis's best work, and although not as well known by any means as anything else really that he wrote, of course we're here to talk Tolkien though, so
all right, so let's talk about Tolkien. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the premise of this new podcast. I think it's called Aman Sul. I'm probably not pronouncing that right as well.
No, you got it.
All right, and I will put, for everybody, I will definitely put a link to that in the description of the video. But maybe you can tell us a bit about the premise of the podcast and where you're going, because I think you're still at the, you have what, two episodes, maybe three now? And so it's at the beginning.
Yeah, the third episode is, I'm not sure when this will air, but the third episode is slated to air on March 25th. So
okay, so I'll probably put this up before.
Okay, great. So we're well underway now. Got a few under our belts, and the whole point of Amansul is, well, first, actually, I should say that where does it now fit kind of in the constellation of Tolkien podcasts? Because there are dozens of them.
Right.
And when I was first conceiving this idea, I was like, man, I mean, how do I even get heard kind of in the midst of all of these other things? I have my own audience. I figure, well, these are the people that I'll start with, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of them. And one thing that I did notice is that most Tolkien podcasts, their deal is essentially, let's take this book or maybe this series of books, and we're going to read through it chapter by chapter and offer commentary along the way, mm-hmm. right? Almost all of them do that. And some of them do it really well. Some of them, not so well.
Not so well,
obviously. Right. I won't name any names.
Yeah, exactly.
But I thought, okay, well, I can't do that because that then, you know, at least puts me doing the same thing that they're doing. And people would say, well, why should I just listen to yet another chapter by chapter commentary? Right. Which, I mean, I think it's a cool approach, but I'm not doing that. Instead, this is a much more topical approach, and it's based on conversation rather than commentary. Although sometimes that commentary is given as conversation. And what we're doing is we're taking themes from Tolkien's works, which include not just his epic fantasy, but also even his letters and some of his non-fantasy works, mm-hmm. We're going to get to, and looking at what he did and asking the question that he himself suggests should be asked from his work. So we talked a little bit about allegory just a couple minutes ago when we were talking about C.S. Lewis and, you know, Aslan equals Jesus, that kind of thing. So Tolkien doesn't like allegory, and he's very explicit about that in one of his prefaces to The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
But instead he favors what he calls applicability.
Yeah. Right?
So if I had to pick one word for what it is we're trying to do with the Amansul podcast, it's this question of applicability.
Right.
And as a Christian and as a specifically Orthodox Christian, then that's the kind of applicability that I want to talk about. And so just to give some examples of where we've already gone. So for instance, the very first episode, which I did with my friend Stephen Cristoforo, we talked specifically about this question of accessing the transcendent in an immanentized experience of the world, which is what most of us are having most of the time.
Right.
How do Tolkien's works help us to navigate that? And like one of the things that we talked about in the midst of that first episode was the fact that that journey is actually being taken by the hobbits, mm-hmm. in The Lord of the Rings. You know, they live in this town where everything is agrarian and domesticated and pastoral, and life is about creature comforts, yeah, and family and friends and, you know, all that good stuff, yeah. right? But the idea that there's dragons, that there's wizards, that mm-hmm. there's anything outside of, you know, the four farthings of the Shire.
There's a bigger story happening here.
Right. They're just not even aware of that. Mm. And when it might exist in kind of old tales, you know. Yeah. And then one guy who goes off to kind of experience that comes back and everyone regards him as kind of crazy, right? So it's kind of Plato's cave, you know, all over again. And you know, the hobbits leave the Shire and they're being coached along the way by people like Aragorn and Gandalf, actually how to navigate this much larger story, including transcendent elements.
Yeah.
Right. So for instance, hobbits will just talk about anything anywhere as an example. And sometimes Gandalf or Aragorn in particular will say, don't talk about that here, or, you know, let's wait until morning, or that kind of thing, suggesting that there is power in language mm-hmm. that they're not aware of.
Right.
So that was one thing that we did. And then in my second big episode, which is actually episode 3, which I did with Deacon Nicholas Kotar.
Yeah, we had him on our channel. We did a discussion with him, so people will want to check that out.
Yeah, yeah. We talked specifically about storytelling. So some of the same stuff you talked with him about, at much greater length, and, what impact does reading stories and of storytelling have on us as human persons? And how does that connect us with prayer? And how does that connect us with saints? So it is this question of applicability. And you might describe it as pastoral theology, maybe, but I wouldn't narrow it to just that. you know, but that's kind of what we're trying to do. And, you know, some of the episodes are going to be more sort of higher level analyses with a lot of theology. And then others are going to be not so theologically nerdy, I guess.
How does theology become nerdy? How did that happen?
It just does. But, you know, I mean, my deal is that I'm kind of a popularizer anyway. It'll never get academic. You know, that's kind of not what we're doing. So that's what Aman Sul is about. And the reason why we chose the title in particular is that Aman Sul is a place in the Tolkien Legendarium where it's also called Weathertop. Aman Sul is its Sindarin name, which means hill of wind. And it's a place where a number of events happen in the Legendarium, but especially for those who are familiar with Lord of the Rings, it's where the Hobbits, along with Aragorn, have that battle with the Nazgul, mm-hmm. and the Witch King of Angmar stabs Frodo in the shoulder with the Morgul blade. So it's a really important place, not just because of that event, but for lots of other reasons. If you want to hear about all of that, listen to episode 2. I'm just sort of plugging as I go.
That's right. That's all good.
So that's what it's about. And there's all these questions of memory and of seeing, you know, from a far distance and seeing things that are not normally visible to the eye. Mm-hmm. All of these are themes that have to do with Weathertop, actually.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
And so I like all of that. And I wanted to kind of make that a lot of the recurring motif in the podcast.
Yeah. I really want to get back to this idea. To me, the issue that you talked about, and that Tolkien said he doesn't like allegory. I've always really felt sympathy for what he was saying, and I've always felt like people didn't understand what he meant. And I'm not sure I totally understand what he meant, but I have my own idea for the reason that I don't like allegory, which is that, let's say, what I would call true symbol, like fake symbolism, is the kind of, not fake, or lower symbolism, or lower imagistic speaking, is the kind that we talked about, where it's like this figure represents this other figure. So, you know, I'm going to write a story, and then there'll be a figure that's going to be a veiled allusion to Donald Trump, let's say. And so here's this character who represents Donald Trump. And that, to me, is a kind of very weak version of imagistic speaking, and you could call that allegory or metaphor or something like that. And to me, true symbolism is something which is structural. That is, there's an underlying structure which is actually the structure of reality. It's like you've actually intuited the structure of how the world lays itself out in terms of what a story is, in terms of how we experience the world, and in terms of how we are living in the world. And then you create this story that follows that pattern. And so then, like you said, I like the word applicability, because then you can say, you can kind of see through the story, the pattern, and then you can apply it to anything, right? You can apply it to any aspect of your life, because it has a universal aspect to it, or a universal structure, you could say, or something of that. I always call it, like, it's actually how you experience the world. It's like some people are able to intuit it, and so they are able to lay it out in a fictional story. But it's fictional, but it's not like you said, it's not just this character represents war, or this character represents the, you know, Hitler in World War II, or the this aspect represents a nuclear bomb or something like that. Like, to me, that is a weak use of symbolism.
Yeah, and I think that when a story becomes allegorical, I think you're on the right track in terms of my understanding of what Tolkien is criticizing in terms of allegory. You know, what happens then is your ability to process it becomes reduced, because it's only supposed to be about this one thing.
Yeah. You know?
I got there, I learned my lesson. Now what, you know? You know, meanwhile, like, for instance, I've already gotten lots of email for this podcast, which has really been amazing to me. And one of the emails that I got, we actually featured on one of the episodes, at least a portion of it. There's this man who talks about how when he was young, he had a very difficult life, and actually was contemplating suicide on a number of occasions. And that the thing that pulled him away from that is a scene from The Two Towers, where Aragorn is standing up on the battlements of Helm's Deep, you know, in the face of just incredible odds. I mean, they're going to be defeated, as far as you know, by that point in the story. Mm. And he stands there in the face of all these massive, horrifying monsters and tells them to be gone, you know, get out, because you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. You don't know what is going to happen in the new day. And this man told me in this email that that scene inspired him to sort of face down his own demons, even as a kid, and tell him to get out, you know, because he didn't know what tomorrow was going to bring. And, you know, that is one kind of applicability where you can identify yourself. Now, he can't look at Aragorn and say, I'm like Aragorn, you know, because he's just a kid.
Well,
right?
He could, but he might be.
Maybe. But Aragorn doesn't stand for him. Like,
right,
like
exactly.
You would have to be really kind of, you know, deluded to think that. But if you were told that Aragorn stands for Jesus, and that's all Aragorn kind of is just this. Now, I would say he is a kind of Christ figure. But if that he stands, he's a stand-in for Jesus, then it's harder to kind of say, well, I can be like that and you know, face down the demons. Because you could say, well, he's God, so of course he can make that kind of comment. You know, of course he can say, yeah, tomorrow I'm just going to blast you, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that also this realm of applicability opens up all kinds of possibilities for conversation, right? You know, it's not this sort of contained discourse where if you say, well, I want to connect it. Like, for instance, when I talked with Deacon Nicholas Kotar, we talked about hagiography, and he even talked about hagiographies that were sort of invented for saints about whom there was almost no historical data.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, if it's just allegory, that's what Lord of the Rings is, then you kind of have no right to sort of import that,
yeah,
you know, and connect that. But applicability, absolutely, you know. Right.
I think that's a really, and the thing is, like, for example, that scene that you mentioned in terms of Aragorn standing on the wall, looking at the hordes, there is in that scene a, what I would call a structural element, which is right. Like it's the right image for that experience that this person was having in terms of being faced with, you know, these demons in his life and feeling overwhelmed. And so, because it's so obvious for us when we see it, because it's so intuitive, we see that scene and it's so intuitive that we can't really explain. It's like this, of course, this is what it should be. But yeah, you can imagine another scene, for example, where it's someone sitting at a table eating a feast, and then that's a different scene. Like he couldn't say to the demons, be gone, because he's sitting inside the castle at a table eating food. And so the fact of standing on a wall already is something that we can analogically experience in our life, this idea of being on the limit of something. We can experience in terms of meaning, not just in terms of physical reality, but the analogy is actually real of being on the edge. We use it, that experience, that expression all the time to talk about someone who is strained, who is faced by all these difficulties, like he's standing on the edge. And so standing on the edge and then having the courage to look straight on at these demons, not hide, not just pretend they're not there, but to look at them and to say, okay, I'm not going to pretend, but I'm going to tell you, I'm going to say, go, be gone, because I trust the few, like, I trust, I mean, obviously I would say I trust God, but I have trust that things can change. I have trust that this situation is not eternal. This situation is not the one that is going to pervade. And so that's where you see this, like you said, this applicability coming from something which is so right intuitively, you know, it hits you right there in a way that is almost impossible to explain for so many people. You know, they have that, so many people that I know had that experience, for example, watching Braveheart, where wife, she said Braveheart is basically one of the reasons why she kind of came back to Christianity, you know, who she kind of really rededicated her life, and it never stopped since then because of that because of an imagistic taking you through the story of someone who's faced with insane opposition but won't back down and you know, will go until the end. It shows you that how stories and how participating in a story is really a kind of therapy, you could say. It's a kind of it can be a reprogramming of your life. It can be a reprogramming of reality. And so that's why I tell people that the liturgical experience or the liturgical year and the liturgical calendar is the ultimate version of that. where right. we follow the story of Christ through the year. And we, especially during this time now, during Lent and then during Holy Week and at Pascha, it's like we are diving into the story. We're going through, we're lamenting with Christ's death. We're doing all that because we know that engaging in stories and participating in them actually transforms reality, transforms the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we try to present, like, for instance, if I were to, you know, had talked to this man when he was a kid, and said to him, now look, you know, sure, you're being bullied and, you know, you're valuable. You should don't kill yourself, you know, like that falls much flatter
yeah.
than seeing this image of, you know, this man who's destined to be king, but maybe he's not going to make it, you know, by that point of the story, you kind of don't know that that's actually going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's something about images, there's something about story that actually, in a sense, is much more convincing in terms of altering the way that I function than, you know, actually it reorients my desires in a way that is far more powerful than simply offering an argument. And, you know, the irony, of course, is that here in the early 21st century, we still kind of, at least tend to speak as though, you know, these Enlightenment ideas of, well, if I make a rational argument, then I'll convince you. And having convinced you now, that will change the way that you live. You know, that will change your behavior. That, you know, you know, this is ironic because that's not the way that human beings actually tend to function.
Right, exactly. You know?
There's a difference between saying, okay, I agree with you, because you're making an argument that I can't overcome, and actually becoming a different person or being,
exactly.
you know, and
can be even worse when you've received the logical argument and you know that you should change something, but it's like, it's not happening. It can make it worse.
Yeah. Like it can lead in fact to despair instead.
That's right.
You know, like I know, I mean, and you know, the Apostle Paul wrestles with this. I know the good, but I don't do it. You know, and I do the evil that I don't want to do. And, you know, and so that's an indication of an orientation of desire. Mm-hmm. And orienting desire is a different ball game, really, than just setting out arguments and convincing people. And I mean, you know, it's funny, even just kind of in our political arena, we have lots of arguments that go back and forth, and yet no one seems to be convinced.
Yeah.
No matter how good and how well refined, you know, the arguments are made. And I that's one of the reasons that I love Tolkien's works is that he offers an image of how to be, an image of how to think, how to desire, how to live, that is actually much more kind of immediately accessible and not imposing itself on the person.
Yeah.
It really is
yeah.
kind of an invitation,
yeah.
you know? So like, you know, at the end of The Hobbit near the end of The Hobbit, where Thorin says to Bilbo, essentially, you know, if people were more like you, you know, really valuing, you know, good food and good cheer over hoarded gold, then the world would be a better place, right? It would be a happier place. And that's a much more powerful moment, having lived the story up to that point, than someone simply saying, now look, it's not good to be greedy.
Yeah.
Right. Just sort of like moral precepts, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's room for those. Like there's room for those. I mean, we have them. Yeah. We also have in the Bible, but like you said, once it enters into the story realm, and once you have examples and you have people that you can look up to, that whether it's in fictional stories or it's saints that have lived that way, and then you can kind of engage with those stories, then the transformational aspect is far greater.
Yeah.
I think that's inevitable. And I think, yeah,
even the Bible is much more narrative than it is kind of.
Of course. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I always try to help, because people really struggle. Modern people really struggle to understand liturgy and understand the liturgical way of seeing the world and the liturgical experience and the liturgical year, all those things. It's so hard for people to understand why would waste our time, you know, celebrating Pentecost and Ascension you know, why do we have these long services that kind of take you through? And I mean, it's difficult for people to fully grasp, especially when they see a liturgy for the first time. But once you start to understand the pattern within the liturgy, you see that it is also it has a story form. It's taking us into the mystery, and there's different cycles where it's like moving you closer and closer to the mystery, you know, and then closing off the doors and then bringing us in and then uniting us with the angels. And so there's this whole I mean, it's almost more like a poem in that sense. It's almost more like a song or like a poem, which also has a pattern form, which is kind of bringing you towards this crescendo, you could say, moment. And that it's those types of structures, those types of experiences, which although sometimes might not be as transformational on an immediately emotional experience, you know, that, you know, you don't necessarily leave the church crying and regretting, you know, your sins all the time. But usually that emotional experience of, like, you know, you've been convicted and you go home crying, that usually lasts, you know, a few days and then it's gone. Whereas the deep transformation of the pattern of your being is it's kind of this slow ascension, that we all participate in. And that's something that I've found is, in the liturgical world, like the liturgical Christianity, is something that is difficult to get people to understand, but it's very profound transformation.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I personally experienced Tolkien as a kind of preparation for liturgical mm-hmm. life is because the way that liturgy tells stories is actually a more traditional way of telling stories than we tend to expect now. And I'll give an example of that. So one of the Tolkien podcasts that I listen to, the part that I'm listening to right now, they're going through the Silmarillion. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, which is sort of Tolkien's Old Testament kind of
thing. Which I have not read, by the way, the Silmarillion.
I
look at it and I get discouraged looking at it.
No. My 9-year-old son is tearing through it.
Okay.
So don't worry.
All right.
I know. I was kind of shocked. Like he was like that. He told my wife that I wasn't reading it to my kids fast enough, and so he, when they were at the library together, he went and looked up where they had the copies of Silmarillion and got the librarian to show him where, so he could check his own copy out and not be bound to the one that's locked in my office. And so he's just reading it himself. So anyway, so in this podcast, they're going through the Silmarillion. And often one of the things that they'll say is, oh, you know, here's another place where Tolkien gives a spoiler, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, often in the stories, it'll tell you, often in the title of the particular tale, it'll tell you the end.
Right.
So like, for instance, you know, of the fall of Gondolin, spoiler alert, the city's destroyed. You know, you just look through the table of contents, you kind of know what happens. Now you don't get this as much in The Lord of the Rings. There's not as many kind of spoilers in that sense. But the way that that Tolkien tells stories, particularly in the Silmarillion, is much more helical in that there's a sense of, there's always a kind of a looking forward that's happening, and you know, there's almost an expectation that even the first time you're experiencing the story is already in some sense a repeat.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So liturgical life is that way. Mm. You know, by the time my kids, for instance, become really cognizant of the fact that at Christmas this is really telling a story, a specific story, they will have already heard the story many, many times. You know, another thing that happens, and this does happen in Lord of the Rings, is there are moments which are completely sort of unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And by that, I don't just mean something sort of miraculous happens, but like, for instance, after the death of Boromir, okay, which happens at the end of the Fellowship of the Ring, and you get, I'm sorry, I think that actually happens at the beginning of Two Towers. The books and the movies are starting to sort of...
They meld in your mind.
I know I'm already regretting this because I'm getting email from people saying, that's not what happens in the book. Yeah. I'm like... But anyway, wherever it happens in the books, it does happen that Boromir dies. And now this is something that doesn't happen in the movies, which is that You got Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli, and they put him on one of the boats to essentially give him a burial, not at sea, but in a river, in the water. And you know, they put the swords of his the weapons of his enemies down at his feet, and have his, you know, his hands clasped together on his breast, and then they set him off, and they sing to him. Mm-hmm. They sing this dirge, this funeral dirge that is written for Boromir. Mm-hmm. Right, and it's like, wait, how can that happen? They, you know, how did they compose that?
They're improvising.
Let's work this out right now before we stick them in the boat. There's no way that within sort of the action of the book that can be, and so it's a more mythological way of telling a story. It's kind of breaking its way into this more novel style of story, which mm-hmm. The Lord of the Rings is, right? And that's so liturgical,
right?
Right. It's, you know, for instance, when in Holy Week, when there's kind of even moments of sort of reenactment, it's not just now, let's just tell the story and then we'll have a kind of a commentary later. Commentary is happening the whole time.
Right.
There's all kinds of like, let's pause here at this and sing a whole song about it, you know, which kind of doesn't make sense in terms of the sort of action movie way of telling stories.
Which
we're more used to now, but it makes total sense in a more mythological way of telling story.
Yeah.
In which it's a communal experience that's repeated over and over. And so then the funeral dirge of Boromir becomes part of the story, not because that's what happened in the moment. Mm. Like, it couldn't have happened. Right, it just doesn't humanly make any sense.
Yeah,
you know, they didn't.
No, see that. I totally agree that some of my favorite moments during Holy Week are those moments where there's that, you know, at the crucifixion of Christ, there's a deep mourning of Christ's death, but then it's almost they're still telling us, well, he's coming back, and they're calling calling like resurrect, like we're calling to Christ to resurrect. And so it's a very different way of telling a story, and it is like this cyclical kind of, we know it's going to happen, we're still participating in it, and it's transforming us, but we know the telos of this thing, you know. And so I totally agree, it's a very different way of telling stories, and it's something that we, you know, this idea of the shock ending, or this idea, like you said, of the spoiler, is something that ancient people didn't care at all about, because
no.
It was a participatory storytelling. And so you just enter into the story and you kind of enact it. Even when they would tell the stories of, you know, when people would tell the stories of the Iliad, or or they would tell poems of ancient Greece or whatever, you know, there was this everybody knew was going to happen, but it was, they still are going to hear it every year, or, you know, several times a year, they're sure going to enter into it and know that it's their story and that they're engaging in it.
Yeah. And within that context, then novelty, which still has a place, becomes about delighting and about finding a new angle to see the story, mm-hmm. you know? So for instance, within the church year, there's new hymns that are written.
Right.
You know, that have to do with the exact same events that we've always been talking about. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, why is it that with, you know, this massive corpus of stuff that's been published after Tolkien's death, why is it that people want to read like five different versions of Beren and Lúthien? Because it kind of doesn't matter that even they don't even work with each other entirely. I mean, it's still kind of one story, but like, for instance, Beren and Lúthien in the Silmarillion, Beren is a human, he's a man, but in the sort of novel version, so to speak, that just came out within the past couple of years, Beren is actually an elf, mm-hmm. which radically changes the whole story of Beren and Lúthien, because kind of the whole deal, or so we thought, was that Lúthien, an immortal elf, joins himself to Beren, a mortal man, and so then she accepts death. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's not how it works out in the version. You know, it's not the same story exactly, and yet the fact that we kind of approach it from different angles, and even some of the details don't match up.
Yeah.
That's okay within a mythological way of telling stories. And if you think about just the four gospels.
Yeah, of course.
Like, there's not a perfect harmonization that can happen with all of the details in the four gospels. And you know what? That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. And it wasn't, I would say it wasn't even expected in the first century that was the way you would tell storytelling. Yeah. Like, let's make this into the kind of thing that is perfectly consistent, you know, for a court of law, you know? So yeah, there's, there's, like I said, and it's funny because, I mean, I've been Orthodox for over 20 years now, but I've been the whole time kind of gradually working out how it is that my experience of Tolkien's works prepared me for a liturgical life and continues to deepen it, right? It continues to deepen it over and over and over again. You know, like, I'm a priest, so my job is to stand at an altar and offer up a sacrifice of bread and wine. That is sort of the key core thing that I do with myself. And, you know, the idea that I would stand there on the threshold of the transcendent and make this connection, not on behalf of people, like they're not there and I'm doing it instead of them. I'm not a proxy, but rather that I'm at the head of them and saying, now come follow me, you know, in some sense, you know, isn't that kind of sacrificial action a very much a sort of a Gandalf way of being? You know, Gandalf's job is not to solve everybody's problems.
Yeah.
You know, Gandalf's job is to point them towards ultimately the will of the one God, you know, which in Tolkien's world is called Eru Iluvatar.
Yeah.
Although he doesn't.
He does that by bringing them along on the story, like taking them into a story.
Exactly. And of course, then there's even within the story itself, you get moments where people reflect on the fact that they're in a story.
Yeah, I know. That's,
you
know,
it's not sort of the pulling back, you know, removal of the so-called fourth wall, like in theater, but there is a sense of like, we're part of a great tale, you know, and that again sheds another kind of light on what it is that's happening, you know? So yeah, it's endlessly delightful. And I think that delight actually calls forth from us the deepest part of who we really are. You know, there's something about delight that does that.
All right. I think that you've basically wrapped up our discussion. This is a great time to finish it, because it's on a nice high point. So, Father Andrew, I really appreciate you coming here and discussing this with me. And I would want to call everybody to check out Amun Sul podcast. You'll end Father Andrew's other writings and his other podcasts. For all of you that are interested in stories and are looking at Christianity, trying to figure out, what it means to get into that story, what it means to live inside the Christian story. I would say that here are some interesting hints for you to discover that. So Father, and I hope we can do this again. Once the podcast is going for a little while, we'll bring you back and hear some more stories of how it's affecting people.
And you have to come and be a guest on it.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, I am not a Tolkien expert. You know?
Good.
All right. Good. Okay. So, sure. Send me a message and I will be there. So awesome. Everybody, thanks. Thanks again for your attention. I hope you enjoyed our conversation and I'll see you soon.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Symbolic World podcast. As you know, these podcasts are all versions of videos that I put out on YouTube. So if you want to see more, there are a few videos that I don't put up. So if you want to see more of what I'm doing, you can check that out on my YouTube channel. The link is in the description of the podcast. And I hear also that if you do want to help the podcast, one of the ways you can do that is to go to wherever it is you're listening to podcasts and leave a 5-star review. Supposedly, that is quite helpful, so that the podcast gets suggested and promoted and put out there. So once again, everybody, thank you for listening, and I will talk to you soon.